So yeah, so the bodhicitta, put as succinctly as possible, is the state of consciousness when you are freed from self preoccupation, and therefore all energy is liberated and able to be put at the service of other beings. That's the absolute bodhicitta. And the relative bodhicitta is the aspiration, the movement towards occupying that state of mind. So we're going to start off by hearing from Vijaya Mala, senior member of the True Ratna Buddhist Order. When I met Rinpoche in 1983, I was struck by his free spirit, his spontaneity, his joy and his kindness. When I later read about his rigorous training and daily routine, I was a little taken aback. In the West, we do not normally associate freedom with such discipline, yet every day Rinpoche followed a regular routine of about 6 hours intensive meditation practice and ritual performances from 4 a.m. until 10 a.m., with another few hours in the evening. He saw these practices as an essential basis for the development of insight and compassion, the basis from which everything else in his life derived. Rinpoche stressed that he put many, many hours of practice every day of his life into becoming precious, becoming free. The practices allowed him to be free, free of the tyranny of a dissipated, undisciplined mind, of what we might call the ego. His commitment was to share that with others throughout his life. Certainly, by the time I met him, he seemed completely unpreoccupied. He was happy just to look at me and my companions for what seemed like an eternity. He was equally attentive to the young boy who called to play on us on a roughly strung instrument that sounded like droplets falling off Himalayan icicles in springtime, and to each of the children to whom he introduced us in our tour of the school. He was also happy to chat away, telling us now about his travels, now about some of his previous rebirths, and now about the neon revolving prayer wheel on a shelf. But whether the topic was reminiscences or plastic mechanisms, there was the quality of total concentration, the like of which I had not seen since. This inner freedom, this egolessness, had its effect on his outward words and deeds. He lived free of real conflict with others because he was free from the biases or worldly winds, the pulls and pushes of pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, obscurity and fame, that motivate those of us caught up with the concerns of the ego. Rinpoche, beyond these biases of ego, had nothing to fear from the worldly winds, and so he was able to come into real contact with his fellow human beings. Anyone who met Rinpoche would immediately be struck by his profound but unostentatious kindness. When I was preparing to meet him, I did not know what to expect. I knew he was someone for whom my own teacher had the utmost respect. I found my own teacher hard enough to fathom how was I to take this teacher of my teacher. In addition, I had never met an incarnate Lama before. In the end, I didn't need to take him any way at all. He seemed so ordinary, yet extremely attentive and generous, with his time and his reminiscences, as well as with the school's meager facilities. Looking back, what I find extraordinary is that, with all my scrutiny, my desire to find a nice new category of incarnate Lama in which to place him, there was simply nothing for me to get hold of. Instead, I just had to sit there, somehow thrown back on myself by his ordinariness, my expectations rather painfully wriggling on dry land. Rinpoche was taking us in. We were among the first of his Western visitors, and he was intrigued by the fact we had flown halfway across the world in less than a day inside a metal box. He saw us as travellers and compared our journey with the ordeal of his precarious trek across the Himalayas, a bit like comparing a trip on a luxury liner with single-handedly sailing the Southern Ocean. He gave us a string of dried cheese each, traditional gifts to travellers, though he warned us not to eat it, as it was probably rancid. It was a strange feeling to be taken in so fully, something like falling through space, at once frightening and exhilarating. I found myself struggling to hold on to the superficial elements of the conversation, but at the same time wanting to let go into this new territory, this tremendous spaciousness that was opening up as a result of such complete concentration. It was Sangharakshita who first brought our attention to Rinpoche's message of cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love. Sangharakshita pointed out that radiation takes place from a central point that by definition has no magnitude. Rinpoche's love radiated out as far as I am concerned, still radiates out from a central point which has no magnitude at all. There are no impurities to get in the way. What is left is therefore an uninterrupted stream of compassion that radiates across space and through time. I think being exposed to this for those few days had the effect of subtly rearranging my constituent parts. I now have a constant reference point in my memory of Rinpoche. When I get too literal about things, or I find myself looking for that big spiritual experience, I can bring to mind the extraordinary ordinariness of his presence. This gives me an almost tangible sense of what it could feel like to be at the same time, full of emotion and yet completely unself-referential. I know it's possible. I've seen it. So that's Dada Rinpoche, one of Sangharakshita's key teachers, talking about her encounter of meeting him. So I suppose for me that very eloquently evokes this experience of the absolute bodhicitta. To put it prosaically, freedom, ease, peace of mind, freedom from self-preoccupation. And this is, this is what the Buddhist tradition is saying is possible. This is the Buddhist tradition is saying this state of mind is possible, is accessible to any human being. With effort, but there's something that I suppose is something about that I just find deeply moving. But of course, one of the challenges we face is that our minds are so preoccupied with criticism, with not good enough, should have been better. So that's, in a way, when we talk about these kind of lofty spiritual ideas, so that's one of the immediate things we have to face. In our little group yesterday, we were talking, one of the subjects we covered was quite early on in his engagement with the Dalai Lama was talking to a bunch of Western Buddhist teachers, and he was asking them, what's the primary problem you face in your teaching? And they went round in a little circle like we do, and every single one of them said something on the lines of lack of self-esteem, self-hatred, not good enough, perfectionism. And what was striking about it is that, by all accounts, the Dalai Lama, he had to work really hard to understand what they were talking about, because he didn't have a category for that experience of not thinking that you're good enough, not thinking that you're worthy of love, thinking that there's something inherently wrong with us. So, and of course, the interesting thing there is then we can give ourselves a hard time for thinking by giving ourselves a hard time. It's like, oh, you idiots, why are you giving yourself such a hard time? So, but let's at least acknowledge that that's a challenge we face. So we've got this evocation of the absolute bodhicitta, both as manifest in living beings and as a sort of a state or an aspect of experience which we can access. But as Karunavajra said last night in the puja, we all have our own glimpses of these experiences. I'm utterly convinced we all have these glimpses of moments when we're not thinking about us, we're not thinking about what other people think about us. We're free, and the delight and the joy that can come from those. So one of, I remember many years ago, probably in my first year or so of practice of Buddhism, I was walking home from the pub on a Friday night, and at this time I was, some of you will have heard this story before, but I like it, so, and some of you haven't. So I was walking home from the pub on a Friday night, and I was, at that time I'd just started volunteering for the, to work in, as part of the Buddhist movement, so I didn't have very much money, and I was in an extended 20-minute long mental conversation with myself about how I was going to make the cannabis that I'd had to last for the rest of the week. And it's like, how am I going to do this? And it's like working out how I was going to do it. So I'm very, like, totally preoccupied with that. And suddenly I was just walking past the bus stop. I can remember the bus stop. And this guy said, got any weed, mate? Which at 2 o'clock in the morning, is half 11 in the morning, is a relatively unusual thing to say to a random stranger. And I just, and I, my immediate response was, yeah. And he said, okay, shall we have a spliff together? And I said, no, mate, I can't do that. I've got to get up to work tomorrow morning. Here you go, just have some. And he was like, okay, cheers. And I walked off. And about a minute or two later, it suddenly occurred to me that I'd been totally preoccupied for like 20 minutes with myself and limit and resources and not enough. And then somebody had asked me for something, and I'd just given it to them. I thought, God, that's weird, isn't it? Like, how did that happen? Just that immediate responsiveness of generosity and kindness. About a minute after that, I realised that I kind of felt my self-identity come crashing back in. And it's like, oh, look at me. Aren't I a clever, generous Buddhist acting out of selflessness? I can tell everyone about that, and they'll be very proud of me. It was years before I told anybody about that, because it's just like, oh yeah, because it's like, how can you, yeah, this moment of openness and selflessness, and then the sort of the ego reappropriates it and says, look at me, aren't I clever, I kind and helpful. So that's the challenge, isn't it? We have these moments of openness and generosity, and then the ego reemerges. And in some ways, we just have to be at peace with that, because that's what it's like to be alive. So you'll see my second line here. We've got these. So this is a very classic Buddhist list, which I really like reapplying. So we've got the words wrong, right, and perfect. Yeah. So most of you will be familiar with that. So of course, this is particularly good for our perfectionist kind of binary thinking minds. So things are either perfect or they're wrong. Guess what, folks? If it's perfect or wrong, then everything we've ever done is wrong, which is not a good situation to be in. So what the Buddhist tradition means by, so perfect in this context is an action, is a mental state which is liberated, which is free from self-preoccupation, which is spontaneous, natural, embodied with wisdom and compassion. What is wrong? Of course, wrong is a relative term here. Well, wrong is actions which are completely motivated by self-aggrandizement, greed, delusion, what's the other one? Hatred. So what's Buddhism is about what's technically called right. Well, this is normally talked in terms of views, but I think it can apply to everything. Right with asravas. Asravas is a technical term which means kind of complexity, mixedness. Well, I've put it here with right with self. Yeah. So this is the primary realm in which we're working in our lives. It's like, We're doing good things, but there's still a level of self-preoccupation tied up with it. And this is completely okay, because this is all we've got. Yeah, this is the middle ground between... that most of the time, we're not wrong, you know. We're not completely defined by greed, hatred, and delusion. Most of our actions aren't that. But most of our actions aren't perfect. So this is the middle ground. This is the working ground. This is the world of... Yeah, doing the metta-bhavana and trying to be generous to people who wind you up. This is doing the mindfulness of breathing and just thinking, okay, what would it be like just to stick with my breath for 3 breaths before I start thinking about what nice lunch we're going to have? Yeah. This is the world we live in. This is the working ground. So in some ways, yeah, that's a simple... But yeah, it's that simple. So particularly, I suppose, this right with self. So in this context, it's right altruism. Altruism which is a genuine desire to contribute, to help, to make the world a better place. But there's a degree of there's an inevitable degree of self-interest tied up with it. And that's okay. It's got to be okay, because that's what it is to be human. So you could say that right with self is for the relative bodhicitta. It's an aspiration to contribute to the well-being of others for our benefit and for theirs. And in some ways, many of you will have heard me say this before, it's like, just think win-win. Helping other people, we feel good, they feel good. Don't make it more complicated than that. It is that simple. So to say a bit more about this relative bodhicitta, right altruism with self, I suppose one of the ways I frame it, it's like it's an aspiration to live a life of benefit. Aspiration to live a life of benefit, to contribute. So without unduly putting my fellow ward members on the spot, you can do a bit of kind of further investigation over the course of today and the rest of your lifetimes. Because one of the things that we do at the point of joining the Tree Rattana Buddhist Order is actively, ritually express that aspiration to benefit others. So we do that in the context of ordination vows. There's four vows. So I always go blank when I think of those. The two important ones, the other ones I'll come back to in a minute. In harmony with friends and brethren, with... What's the other one? I accept this ordination, thank you. What's the next one?
With loyalty to my teachers.
With loyalty to my teachers, that's what I was forgetting. So with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. So that's quite a thing to say in a ritual context, isn't it? For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So as I say, I invite you over lunch and over drinking cups of tea to ask people how they make sense of that in their lives. I'm genuinely curious. It's a question I ask myself ongoingly. I know it's important to me. I know it means something to me. Reading that passage described in Gaudiya Rinpoche, reading it last night, it makes me cry. This the aspiration, the simple truth of it. The beauty of love. In some ways, it's as simple as that. The beauty and power of love. That is what I try to live my life for. So, again, last night, one of the things Karuna Vajra said was, this is classic Sangharakshita. He suggests that the bodhicitta is more likely to arise amongst groups than it is amongst individuals. So I think that's something worth pondering. I suppose for me, it's one of the answers I come to that is because, the encroachments of self, the dangers of self-aggrandizement, I'm going to save all beings. Sangharakshita just makes it clear, that's insane to think that you are actually going to save all beings. It is not possible. But as a collective, as a group of people, we can move towards something, we can contribute, we can improve the world, we can live lives of benefit. And so of course what's really important here is just to be thinking, I'm going to ask you this more directly in a little bit, I have complete confidence that all of us express this altruism, this desire to benefit beings in different ways throughout our lives. So it's really important to have a sense of and value and strengthen that aspiration. That's where it comes from. If you can't, again, we have this sort of black and white, good and bad thinking, which just doesn't work. So it's like, okay, so where am I already acting with altruism? How can I value that more? How can I let that purify, let it be a little bit less about me and a little bit more about the other people? So again, one of my favourite stories is on an early young Buddhist Buddhist retreat, the first retreat they held at Adastana. It was for sleepy afternoon meditation, which I was just encouraging you all to go to, which I didn't go to because I stayed up too late chatting to people. And I went to get a cup of tea, and I took the last mug, made my tea, and then I had this little thought moment. I thought, aha, in 45 minutes, 120 people are going to want a cup of tea, and there are no mugs. So there's a little choice point there, isn't there? And I'm pleased to report that I spent the next 40 minutes washing up mugs, which I was sort of okay with, actually. I was like, this needs to happen, people need tea, they want tea, that's okay. But what was evidently apparent to me within the first 5 minutes of doing that is that I am not doing this out of selflessness. I'm doing this and I want recognition because I want to be in bed having a nap and everybody's going to know about it. Well, not everybody, but at least enough people are going to know about it because I'm going beyond myself and somebody else needs to know about that. And in some ways it was fine because the mug still got washed. But I remember thinking at the time, it's like, oh yeah, if you were free from self-preoccupation, you'd just do this and then go off. And everybody just, and nobody would notice, there wouldn't be this ripple of kind of self. It's like this ripple of self. Look at me, I've been helpful. It's good to be helpful, but it's also good to, well, in a way, it's like recognise that when we make those ripples of self, ties to future suffering. In that case, what would it have been if somebody just said, well, you should have done that. What are you looking for praise and recognition for? I'd have been pissed off and kind of resentful. That wouldn't have done me or anyone else any good. I'm going to read you one of my favourite lines again. So this is chapter 8, verses 134 to 137. I read from yesterday as well. The calamities which happen in the world, the sufferings and fears, many as they are, they all result from clinging onto the notion of self. So what good is this clinging of mine? If one does not let go of self, one cannot let go of suffering, as one who does not let go of fire cannot let go of burning. Therefore, in order to allay my own suffering and to allay the suffering of others, I devote myself to others and accept them as myself. So I just find that a really beautiful evocation of what's possible. I invite you to call to mind what times when you have just very naturally and spontaneously responded and helped and given. Value those more strongly, kind of cherish them. And in some ways this is, it's like let them grow and expand so that they become more and more of the way in which we see the world, more and more which we relate to the world. So I suppose one of the things I was thinking about as I was thinking about this last night was, you'll be familiar, but there's all these, Shantideva says things like, at night, this is chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, at night in darkness, thick with clouds, a lightning flash gives a moment's brightness. So sometime by the power of the Buddha, the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of merit. This being so, the power of good is always weak, while the power of evil is vast and terrible. What other good could conquer that, whether not the perfect awakening mind? So in some ways, for me, I think this is, again, it's this thing of... Well, at some point, something else needs to come in. We can't, like a bigness. It's like those moments of altruism where we're not thinking about how other people are going to think of us. We just act. Without those, then I suppose the image which was coming to me yesterday, it's a bit like we're trying to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. And it's just really hard work. So one of the things, as I was thinking about this yesterday, I was just thinking, oh yeah, so this beauty of living a life of love, of contribution, and it's hard. As you know, I'm incredibly fortunate. I spend my time, I'm working. I spend my time teaching people about Buddhism, trying to help them understand, to grow. Such an incredible opportunity, such a gift. And yet, what I find really painful is I get to the end of my day and I get home, and I want to escape. I just this impulse to escape. And I find that really puzzling. I find it really hard to know what it is that I want to escape from. And I think what it is that I want to escape, what I want to escape from is the sense of me doing things. So it's like, I'm doing this and I'm trying to help people. It's like, I like Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that. So it's like these metaphors. It's like trying to help people go up levels in some Dungeons and Dragons game. And it's like, oh, look. Anna just became a Mitra, she's gone from level 4 to level 5, and she's got a little star. Yeah. I don't think like that, just to be clear, but it's like, but it's so tiring, God, it's so tiring. So I get home, and I just want to escape into a world which is free from me. I want to escape into a world which is free from me. And I just feel, like, I increasingly think that's the primary problem I face in my spiritual life, is like how to escape from that meanness. It's like, I live a life of benefit, of contribution, could do better, of course. But it's like it's a real challenge, And I know it's not just me, one of my little, so you can do this as well, this will really embarrass the auto members, I don't know the answer to this, you can ask them what they do when they get home from classes, so this is a little thing I talk about. Yeah. So we kind of, we're there kind of saying, be aware, be kind, be free, then we go home and we're eating toast and watching Netflix like all of you. Hard. I don't know what this lot do, it's one of the things I ask my friends, because I think, this is where we need to help each other, this is where the Sangha can help each other, just being honest, is sharing that challenge and trying to find ways of doing it better, and recognising and celebrating the good that we do. So that's a little bit of a ramble, but... I could have kind of done loads of technical stuff about what the bodhicitta is, but I just didn't want to. So I haven't. So the absolute bodhicitta is freedom, ease, and particularly, I think this is a crucial thing, for peace that arises when you let go of self-preoccupation and the energy which is then accessed to be able to contribute to the world, which is why one of the lines which I was... annoyingly unable to find earlier when I was looking for it. There's a line when Shantideva's talking about energy, and he has a number of different images. So he says he talks about like a great elephant just like jumping from pond to pond, ready for the next task. It's like, just like, let's go. That's what the absolute bodhicitta is like. There's an ease, there's a freedom there. There's another set of images. It's often about water, where he describes it. He says it's he describes going into hell, like a flock of geese landing on a bunch of lotus pads. It's like hell it's not scary, it's not hard. When you're free from self-preoccupation, you just go and you're open and you help. So that's the vision of Buddhism, that's the invitation. Absolute bodhicitta as a state of mind which can be experienced. Absolute bodhicitta as a quality of consciousness which exists mysteriously in the universe, which we can tap into. There's only one bodhicitta, as a famous song would have famously have it. So that's perfect. But then the relative bodhicitta is the level on which we're aspiring to operate. The awakening mind should be understood of two kinds, in brief. The mind resolved on awakening and the mind proceeding towards awakening. The distinction between these two should be understood by the wise in the same way as the distinction is recognized between a person who desires to go and one who is going, in that order. Even in cyclic existence, great fruit comes from the mind resolved on awakening. but nothing like the uninterrupted merit that comes from that resolve when put into action. Chapter 1, verses 15 to 17. So it's an invitation to, to kind of, I think it's like in a way, Buddhism is an invitation to trust that the call of our hearts, which says, "I want to make the world a better place." To let go of the cynicism and the fear that holds us back, and trust those shy sproutings of altruism, of love, of care and concern. To trust and value those, and so that they may grow stronger and more powerful, and maybe what we live our lives from. That's what the order is. That's what the order is. It's in a context to express, to live out, to activate those beautiful and potent moments of aspiration to contribute to better for the world.